Continental was closed for 6 hours until the VC attack over there. It was both a mortar and a satchel charge. There were just about 5 VC killed in the perimeter trying to break into the airstrip. So Rowe was late arriving. First attack of that sort in the entire time that I'd been in Saigon. Thompson knew that close.
Yeah. I know there were more attacks to come.
Yeah. So let's see, where were we on your notes? There were.
Lou was late arriving there, but was that all you were going to say about it?
No, that's. That was in connection with this RDC business.
Yeah.
And his being chief, deputy chief of station from the day of his arrival. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to the general staff pacification.
Yeah. Okay. What is the in defining general staff for pacification?
That was
pacification, what is the general staff encompass?
Who knows?
Okay, at this point,
I just had to make it up.
At this point, you're creating the general staff for. Okay,
yeah.
All right. Okay.
But any general staff, of course, I've been through all the history of the German generals.
Well, that's immediately what comes to mind. Right. Is that the American military being based on that?
And the, well, the American military never really adopted the German general staff concept, or even the British.
Okay.
And, but regardless, we encompassed all the functions involved here. If you talk about G1, G2, G3, G4, and so forth, I mean, they're all involved in
that's right.
One way or another in any kind of organizational structure you set up.
Okay.
So in any event, we have the three-pronged ISEX proposal, which involve the plans and programs, the statistical reporting, and the investigations unit.
Now, was your first, you said there was another stroke of genius, and that was to base it on Comer's personality.
The thing is that what was involved in all of this was interagency in nature.
Okay.
Now, when you start fooling around with other agencies,
you're going to come up with somebody somewhere who's going to be unhappy.
You're in trouble. Okay. Not only is there a legislative mandate, there's legislative funding, there's funds obligations, there is accounting procedures. There is a question of who's going to pay for something.
And these are things that I'm very interested in.
There are the bureaucratic empires involved. There are the bureaucratic reputations, both in Saigon and in Washington, deeply committed in these things. But yet you have all these different activities being run by different agencies, military, civilian, intelligence, police, and somehow or another you have to tie them all together.
Yeah.
And so the basic idea of this thing was to set up a board of directors in which the agency head or his deputy, and none other, would be the member. And a reporting system would be established to make it possible for a guy like Comer, this is where it's built around a personality, to hold their feet to the fire.
Okay.
In other words, make each agency respond, make it responsive, make it respond, and to be able to give it goals and targets and to criticize failures in performance, whether deliberately or inadvertently through sloppiness.
Okay.
So this was the basic concept of the whole thing. And this command post structure from Ford Motor Company as a model seemed ideal as a supporting structure for the board of directors, and for Comer.
As chief executive officer.
As chairman of the board, and his own position, Comer's own position, was another bureaucratic anomaly. He was made an ambassador and deputy Thomas McVeigh, deputy to Westmoreland, on a par with, I guess, was General Abrams his...
Westmoreland to begin with.
Well, there's Westmoreland, but I don't know who, I don't remember who Westmoreland's deputy was.
Yeah, it was Abrams. It was Abrams.
Abrams was his chief operations for a period. I guess it was Abrams.
It was Abrams. Deputy. Yeah.
Okay. So Comer and Abrams were on an equal level.
Okay.
Theoretically. And Comer was an ambassador reporting to the ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
He had the title of ambassador, but actually he was reporting to Lyndon Johnson in the White House.
That's right.
Everybody knew that. And so the basic, this was the idea. You set up a structure in which these agencies have to participate, have to bring their resources to bear, utilizing their own resources, their own funds, without any interference with the legislative mandate, or enabling legislation, without any interference with their financing procedures or anything like that. And so it was at this time that we'd gone back to Washington on a cable, outlining the problem, what Comer's wishes were, and what the station had vaguely in mind. And we got this cable back from Colby, which basically says, well, we don't know what you're going to do, but basically, as I recall, they suggested that we sort of pull our horns in. Here's one side of that ongoing debate throughout the agency's history. Not get too deeply involved in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in any event, no matter what you guys out there figure out, we don't want you even to suggest anything involving the committee structure.
Huh.
And this was from Bill Cole.
And I don't know, I guess DC and George Howard too. I just don't know.
So I said, well, screw it. I mean, this is the only way to do it, and we'll go ahead and do it. And came up with our final proposal and had the ambassador's approval out there in the field.
Yep.
And Comer came out and he approved the basic ideas. And so back in Washington, they were left with more or less the same.
They complete. So this is what you meant when you said you did it in opposition to instructions from Washington,
yep, exactly.
Which were to draw back, not
draw
to go ahead.
And avoid any kind of involvement in any kind of committee, interagency committee structure.
I see. Because that was anathema to CIA policy.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. So that's very interesting in the sense that Colby's always designated as the creator of, you know, of the person who brought all the things together, when actually it sounds like, in effect, he was hesitant to go ahead and do it.
Well, this has bearing on two things.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, three things. First of all, as you've already discovered, I can talk a blue streak.
That's okay. I'm here to listen. Please.
And I can talk a blue streak, and this is a kind of opportunity. You know, trading war stories with old colleagues, it gets tiresome after a while. But this is more fun.
Yeah, okay. And
secondly,
I'm an empty vessel filling.
Secondly, I mentioned earlier a certain amount of vanity and people getting credit where credit is due.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, Coley had nothing to do with Phoenix.
Okay. Well, this was my own... From my own talking with him,
he
knew nothing about
it. He got stuck with it.
Yeah, okay.
When Comer was transferred, I guess, over to Turkey, and Colby was coming in as chief of SR division in Washington.
That's right.
And the week before he was to come in as division chief, he was reassigned by the White House to go to replace Comer. So that would have been December. That would have been Christmas 1967.
Yeah.
Okay. One reason I was anxious to talk to Ralph Johnson, and the reason I'm very happy to talk to you is that maybe if I wind up as a footnote in history, well, then that's all I would want. But
sorry. That's me. No, that's my responsibility.
No, that's all right. We'll just go back to one step. But.
Okay.
That it was between me and John Hart and Comer. And I was seconded over to Comer's office as this thing got more advanced. And Comer's a sticker.
Yeah.
And you're writing and rewriting and rewriting papers over and over until they satisfy him.
Okay.
His basic idea, he was buying everything that we proposed for him. And approved that. But he was beginning, wanted to develop action papers. And this became, boy, this is great.
This is actually directed, said, when you say action papers.
Starting to develop them, yes.
Okay.
And Comer kept repeating over and over, he wanted a rifle shot approach, not a shotgun approach, against the VC infrastructure.
He's always quoted as being saying that he wanted a shotgun approach.
No, he wanted a sniper's attack. He wanted a precisely targeted. Over and over, and I think we'll find documentation for that in the papers.
Good. Okay.
I'm fairly sure.
Okay. Good.
So he was constantly throwing papers back to me to rewrite in those terms.
Okay.
But let's get back to our ISAC staff.
Yep.
We talked about plans and programs section, statistical reporting section, and investigation section.
Yep.
The third element in all of this, going one step behind that, was A, strategy, B, structure, C, management.
Yep.
Once again, another stroke of genius, that I picked up ideas from a little book a number of years previously. The name of that book was Reporting Financial Data to Management. And one of the lessons, there were two things that impressed me about this. First of all, how to focus on the bottom line.
Okay.
Management usually does not need anywhere near the amount of information that it gets.
Detail. They don't want detail.
What you have to do is you always have to ask the question, information for what? Okay. When you're talking about executive management. The second idea, which I picked up out of a little book in a Saigon bookstore, was a Hong Kong reprint of a U.S. textbook dealing with information theory, which conveyed the point of view, which impressed me very much. As a matter of fact, it affected the entire balance of my career in the agency. The use of reporting tool to shape behavior. And so, we designed the reporting structure of this thing, not only to provide critical types of information to this ISEC board of directors and to Comer, but also to, by focusing attention out there in the region and the province on things that we thought were important, to guarantee that those things were
properly. So in other words, the kind of reports that you're going to write up are going to focus.
I had already introduced this approach into the police field operations.
You want to tell me how?
Well, by design of a reporting format. Would have things in there that would seem trivial from the standpoint of what's going on. But among other things, for example, I wanted to know for a regional officer and for a province officer, I wanted him to tell me once a month every place he'd been that month and how long he was there. Okay, now normally this kind of thing wouldn't show up in a report.
Right.
But it was important to me and important to the Vietnamese that our people, A, show the flag, and B, be there when the action is going on.
That's right, and reporting makes for accountability.
And reporting makes them accountable in those terms.
That's right.
That's just a small example.
Okay.
There were some other things. I could drag out some copies of this stuff, I suppose. I think I have too many that could illustrate this kind of thing. But anyway, those were the two ideas involved in the
in this statistical reporting unit for the
ISAC staff.
For the ISAC staff.
Who is now, did who became the head of each of these sections?
I have no idea.
That's
F
after you leave.
That's after I left. Ed Parker continued.
Okay.
Okay. The statistical reporting unit was the unit that was to pull this stuff together and analyze it for the loss. Now everybody lies. So you have a unit over here, a section, which is the field investigations unit. These guys are supposed to be on the road most of the time. Dropping in, of course you can't do it with the military. But the basic idea was that these folks could drop out of the sky and could go and look at your files, among other things. Well, never really went that far.
Mm-hmm.
But still, we had field investigators to go out from time to time and to verify that what's being reported to us in writing is true.
Right, okay, because you can write up a report to say you were here and you were there. And
First of all,
okay.
When you have a well-developed reporting format, basically people can't lie. And you know who the horse shitters are.
Okay.
And you know who's telling the truth. And you know who understates, who doesn't know how to write very well and is uncomfortable writing.
Mm-hmm.
And as you develop a feel for those things, you take all of them into account.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the purpose in this other thing is to do the same sort of thing.
But
also to have this threat, so to speak, if you will, sitting in the background that an investigator could come in any day and check on this stuff.
Now, are these investigators...
Just to keep them honest.
Yeah. Are the investigators... part of the, I understand that the CIA has Office of Security. Are they somehow?
Well, it has absolutely nothing to do with security.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with security. It's
nothing
just
to do with
a
security.
Management system within
that's
the
right,
structure.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's just somebody gets the job of being the inspector.
As a third section of the ISAC staff.
Okay.
Well, okay, so Comer's approved this, and Washington flip-flopped. Once Comer approved it, and the White House approved it, CIA headquarters, Colby, had to go along with it. They had no choice.
Okay.
And so that was... as a matter of fact, they never even answered us.
They just went...
We went in for a request for approval, and nothing ever happened. And we said that this has been approved locally by the ambassador and by Colby, blah, 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 blah. And we'll implement on the following... Something like that.
And just silence.
And just silence. That was the end of that. So, the whole thing was put up as a package. Basically, you've got to remember, if you have a community sweep, for example, in Jiading province, right outside of the military district of Saigon, we had a military operation there, quasi-military, quasi-police operation. We counted something like 17 different intelligence agencies operating in that military district. None of them in touch with the other 16. This was the kind of fiasco that we had to try to. And when I say 16 or 17, I'm talking about combined Vietnamese and Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans have about 6 or 7 in there. So,
so ISAC comes into being?
So ISAC, we put all this together and presented it to the Vietnamese.
Who within the Vietnamese?
And General Luan, by this time, was chief of the National Police, as I recall.
Mm-hmm, okay. Did he have an individual who was his counterpart? Within your group?
I'm trying to think. I know my own boss, Red Stent, was General Laurent's contact for a while there.
Okay.
Jack Stent. He was chief of liaison branch.
Okay.
That was while he was still Colonel Lamar.
Okay.
And see, Laurent had been General Tooze. Really his only confidant.
Yeah, okay.
And I am convinced that Laurent was absolutely honest, dedicated, patriotic.
Really?
Yeah. He's a little shredded bastard. Everybody knows what he looks like. Seen him shoot that VC on the TV screen.
No.
But he was, we did several corruption studies out there. We were never able to. He had no, not even rumors of corruption against him.
Huh, because that's, you know, that book, Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, tags him as being Key's.
I said, too.
You meant Key, right,
I meant
yeah.
Key,
okay.
Russia, Key, yeah.
You know, but they has him as being Key's bagman for the opium trade.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether Key was involved in the opium trade either. There was a lot of stuff going on, but it was mainly, from our reports, it was mainly airdrops.
Yeah.
And who knew who was picking this stuff up? But basically, you know, in those societies, just as in Iran, the pay is minimal.
And I understand that people make their...
And that it's
culturally
understood.
Accepted that this
it's
is the way...
It's understood that this is the way you're going to get your pay. It's through corruption and bribery.
No, I understand that.
Types,
I've had that explained to me by Vietnamese, that they don't have taxes to play for a police force.
Yeah.
Therefore, the police chief has to make his money in order to build up the police force the way he can.
Yeah, right.
Either through gifts from the people or through his
illegal
dealings.
Some of it results in personal enrichment, and a lot of it doesn't.
Right.
We had a lot of people out there with a, boy, they would stink from here to Denmark and back.
Yeah.
But General Marshall Key and General Colonel Lalonde were never ones out there. Two was... he had an unsavory reputation.
Yeah.
Okay. But Key didn't.
Huh.
Okay. No one didn't. Anyway.
You presented it
this to... This was all presented by... now, wait a minute. Did this happen while I was there? After I left, it was presented. Ed Parker was telling me about this.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I was there at the time. That's right. I had come back, and it was presented to...
So it's in that two-month period when you came back, okay.
Yeah. I was presented to the Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese, they didn't take very long to turn the thing down. Mainly because they looked upon it as an infringement on sovereignty.
Okay.
And various other... And I say that Luan was a patriot. He was. He was looking out for Vietnamese.
Okay.
And he recognized the fact that Vietnamese and American interests were not always identical.
Okay.
Which is a very true statement. Well, anyway, that was the dregs of that call. they turned down flat. And we said, well, that's okay, because we're going to do it anyway. My attitude on the thing was, which I told Gomer, Parker, didn't make any difference with the Vietnamese. We could hardly hold ourselves an example up to the Vietnamese if we didn't have our own house in order.
Yep.
And so regardless of what the Vietnamese were going to do, we would do this anyway.
I see. Okay.
And if nothing else, try to serve as a model or as an example of what might be possible. When we talk about bureaucratic infighting and politics and this and
it's
that.
It's even worse within the Vietnamese
it's
structure.
It's even far worse over there. So that... there was no real necessity that the Vietnamese string along with us, so they didn't. Although up in Da Nang, I Corps, they did. Which, by the way, is where the name Phoenix came from.
Oh, how does that, how does it
when,
come?
This was a guy by the name of Jack Horgan. Was our Roik up in Da Nang. And he was in good liaison with both the Vietnamese military and the Vietnamese police up there in I Corps. So he presented this to the Vietnamese, and one of, I guess it was the chief of national police up there, said, well, he said, we should really call this Phoenix, because it's to rise from the ashes and the dust and to seek victory. And so Jack Horgan came down with
report, I forget whether it's a cable or whatever, he says, just saying that, oh, by the way, that so-and-so has coined the name Phoenix for this activity. Took on immediately. And so it became known as Operation Phoenix, and everybody was happy.
So it was Horgan who came up with the name Phoenix?
It was the National Police Chief.
The National Police Chief?
The Vietnamese.
Oh, okay.
Vietnam, Vietnamese in Da Nang.
Huh.
Came up with the name Phoenix. Rising new life from the ashes. So, then it was beginning to go. It was, Comer had written a number of directives and action papers out there. And then F. Parker was, had assembled his staff and was beginning to write his field directives. And that's where they had asked me to come back out to assist in the report, the reporting formats and this and that, to implement this philosophy that I had explained earlier.
What, did you sit down with Parker at this, was that when you meet him for the first time?
I'd never known Ed Parker before.
You know, oh, okay. And so you, was, but you did meet him in those 2 months when you came back.
Yes, that's right. And just a finer gentleman than Ed Parker, you know.
I have an interview with him set up for Wednesday. Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, and I went ahead, I think I wrote you and told you. I had,
yes, you
I,
did. Did you use my name?
Yes, I did. I mentioned I was seeing you Monday. And he was very forthcoming. And he said, I said, I'll be down in the area. Is Wednesday okay? And he said, Wednesday's fine.
Yeah.
Come by.
Well, you're talking to two key guys right now.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited about this week.
Okay, so then world's one of the world's finest gentlemen, fluent French. In Russian, we'd say a kulturna, a cultured individual.
Okay.
And
career CIA, I suppose.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
I know he's been Detachment 101. And,
yeah. I know nothing about that.
Yeah.
But I know there was some such, and that's as far as I know.
Yeah.
So. So reporting formats, requirements, this and that, the next thing. And it was this time that we ran into problems with, as I recall, we ran into problems with Bob Wall.
Did he see this also, as an infringement on his, perhaps, this?
No, Ed Parker is less abrasive than I am. Perhaps.
Okay.
And he would see a problem. He would almost certainly, I know he would seek and almost certainly would find a diplomatic solution to a problem.
Yeah.
Whereas I might seek disciplinary action against somebody, he would seek a diplomatic action.
Okay.
But here we had it was with Bob Wall and the military counterpart, American military counterpart in Region 3, that's an example of the kind of thing you run into. I talked about warlordism.
Yeah. Is this an American or a Vietnamese military?
No, this is an American military.
Okay.
This guy, let's say you have your police field force units. I'm not sure we quite had them at this time yet. They were, I think, in formation, but not yet operational.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. But in any event, police field force, you have your PRUs, you have various other cadres of various types. The military mentality, I mentioned the police mentality is arrest and convict, send them away to jail. Intelligence mentality is to capture and interrogate, or defect, or turn around and place.
Yep. Which to me is the most fascinating.
Military mentality is to set up a battle. Okay, now here you have some very specialized reconnaissance and intelligence units, PRUs, well trained. If the CIA did anything out there in Vietnam, it was to demonstrate that small unit leadership is a critical factor in a guerrilla warfare situation.
Yeah.
The Army never learned this. The Army would train officers till they're blue in the face, but as far as I'm concerned, they didn't spend diddly damn on the corporals and the sergeants, which are, they're the cement that hold a military force together. So small unit leadership is something that the military had lost sight of, but we didn't. Anyway, this military guy in Three Corps, along with Bob Lowell as the ROIC, they were using PRUs and everything else as blocking forces for military sleep operations, that kind of thing. Okay, that's your military mentality.
Yeah.
Military mentality, fight a battle, the police is this, the intelligence, that, and so on. That was one of the questions involved with Three Corps there, the Region 3. And John Vann, as I remember, had gone up to the Trang in Region, what was that, Region 2?
The Trang is 2, yeah, that's the, okay.
That's where he was, at first anyway.
Okay.